Welcome back to Arts About.
Show about art that's a work of art in itself, Sally. Good morning.
Yes, indeed. Good morning, John. How are you this morning?
Good. Thanks for dinner the other night.
Yeah, it was very good, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Hello, Brody, too. Rubbing the knobs quietly over there. Arts About is, of course, brought to you by the generosity of the McClelland Sculpture Park and Gallery and facilitated by the Bendigo Bank Studio. And I've lost my marbles this morning.
Why's that?
I'm not sure. I think I'm just a little bit tired.
Oh, okay.
We've got a brand new Will and Dr. Gabe on.
Yes,
this
that's
morning.
Exciting.
It is exciting. We haven't had a new one for a little while, so it seems like the band is back together again. They're going to be discussing one of the great American masters, Marcus Yakovlevich Rothko. Everybody else knows him as that. I think we're also going to hear from Mark Stewart today.
Yes, Mark's coming in. Mark's lurking about somewhere, looking dark and dangerous.
Yes, and what are you two going to be talking about?
We're going to talk about Degas. Yes. We went to the Degas opening together.
That's right. You mentioned that last week, of course. Wonderful. And what are you going to be on about this
week? I thought I might talk about Let's Go Fishing.
Oh, fishing. Bass
Strait in a storm.
Oh, fantastic. Exciting. All right, that's great. It's been quite a bit about the water and boats and things lately.
There's a theme.
Okay. Now, Cliff is likely to grace us with his presence again, I suspect. And so while we ponder the cosmos in here, let's get Will and Dr. Gabe lined up. And while we do so, here's the wonderful Marvin Gaye wondering what's going on.
Welcome back, everyone. Here we are again with what's been missing on Arts About for almost 2 years. This is a new edition of The Profound Thread. We've had lots of complaints from people about the replays of all the old shows. They've heard all that stuff before. But none of you probably realise that I've had to chase my partner in The Profound Thread, Dr. Gabe North, halfway around the world in order to find where she is and why she's absconded for 2 years. And I've found her today in Prague.
Alas,
good morning, Gabe.
Good morning. Alas, you've tracked me down, Will.
I found you in Prague. What the hell are you doing in Prague?
None of your damn business. I'm on a secret mission, which may be revealed at a later date. You love a secret mission. That should really pique your interest.
I do like secrets.
And I am interested to know where you've been before coming to Prague.
Well, I thought you'd gone to America, so I've been in the States a couple of times looking for you there.
Seen any art while you were there?
I've been in New York, I've been in San Francisco, and I've seen some wonderful art. I love going to American art galleries. The thing that took my interest most was the Rothkos. I saw a magnificent Rothko, one of the earlier ones, which is hanging at the Museum of MoMA in New York.
Yep.
The Slow Swirl at the Edge of the Sea, which is quite different to what other people think of Mark Rothko's.
Oh,
do you know
anything
about Mark Rothko's?
You're talking about one of the paintings from memory from his surrealism period, yeah? It sort of reminds you, it's a bit redolent of, you know, some Whiteleys.
A little bit. It's a bit of a mixture. It could even be...
What is it that takes your fancy about that painting?
Well, I just love the imagery, and it is, it's surrealist, it's cubist.
It's the vibe, it's the
marbo.
It's the vibe is a very, very good way to describe Rothko, because four words come to mind when I think of Rothko, which are prick of a man.
That's what I've heard.
He's somewhat underwhelming as an individual, at least from what I can read in biographies. But you just can't get away from the fact that as an abstract expressionist, it just doesn't get any better, Will, does it?
No, well, in San Francisco just a couple of weeks ago, I saw, of course, Rothko didn't, I don't think he gave any titles to his paintings, but there was a great big one at the newly reopened San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. The top of the stairs, turn right, and there it is. It's huge. I think it's just called number 14.
Oh, yeah. Well, the numbers mostly came from his wife, who would catalogue them for exhibitions so that they could be identified and sold. But I know exactly the one you're talking about. You must, for the sake of our listeners, put that up on the Facebook page for Arts About so they can share your love of that image, because it is an extraordinary painting.
Well, I'll try. It's very big. I'm not sure how we'll get it up on the Facebook page. page, but we'll do our very best.
So nice to be back in cheesy dad joke land. Yeah. But look, honestly, how's that sort of halo effect, those floating forms? I think they are extraordinary. And even at his most monochromatic, he still has a sheen and a matte finish that he contrasts against one another. And it's just an incredibly complex work.
I love them. I always have. I think I promised you years ago that I'd get you a Rothko one
day. You did. I mean, you only did 836. Could it have killed you to get me one?
Yeah, well, I did. I brought you one back. It was from...
It was a postcard. No, was it a fridge magnet or a postcard?
It was a fridge magnet.
Yeah,
I think.
Thanks very much. Yeah. Most generous.
Yeah. Now, I'm interested to know, do you know much about the things that grab me most are the practical things like his workshop and his paints and his benches. Do you know much about Mark Rothko, how he works?
Yeah. He's much more interesting when you look at his materials and techniques, because the way he uses colour and transparency and viscosity in the paint and the reflectance of the paint, the way he manipulates the media is what's interesting to me. As a person, I find his life just, well, it was a bit of a waste in the end. I think the man died at 66 over a sink, having got the razor blades to the wrists. And unfortunately, his son Christopher, who was only 6 at the time, lost his mother a year later. I think the interesting story behind any Rothko would be how Christopher Rothko came out after all of that. But I'm with you. I find what's so interesting is that cloud-like, translucent, opaque feeling they're elicited in his works. And the way that he did these canvases starts off in a very, very primitive way, just with the old cotton duck canvas that someone like John Baird would be very, very familiar with, attached to wooden strainers. And the depth of his paintings are also a bit of a hallmark, because, as you know, they're generally frameless.
They're frameless. I'm curious also whether Rothko ever had assistants helping him, or did he do all this by himself?
Yeah,
he was not well, was he?
Oh, look, he wasn't.
He had everything wrong with him.
Oh, yeah. He's as miserable as all buggery as well. Yes, that's in fact a bit of a profound thread, Will, because when you look at the famous Renaissance biographer Giorgio Vasari talking about Michelangelo and the painting of the Sistine Ceiling, Vasari was keen to say, oh, Michelangelo did it all on his own, every brushstroke was his, when in fact, in real life, he had a team of assistants, as did Rothko. The virtuosity of the artist is not just in his ability to apply paint to a canvas, but to conceptually unify a work of art using a team of assistants is quite incredible. And in this case, Rothko had a couple of assistants on his oversized canvases working at any time together. And Rothko would sit back and instruct the assistants on the application of the paint, and they'd work from top to bottom or from sides inward, while Rothko himself orchestrated the activity. I think the acceptance of assistance affirms the certainty of his critical eye, that he could stand back and say, this is how I want to orchestrate a painting, just as brilliant as him applying every stroke himself.
Another thing that I noticed, and maybe I'm not the first person to notice this, that there are little paint runs, I suppose you'd call them drips. Some of them were running upwards. How does that work? Did the San Francisco MoMA make a mistake and hang this one upside down?
Some idiot, hapless, moronic person who was left in charge of hanging the painting? No, that's not the case. Rothko's actually known for changing the orientation of the canvas in the process. And sometimes he gets halfway through a work and then he'd change the direction of the canvas, even from portrait to landscape or vice versa. But the funny thing is, there's actually a very famous 1960 painting in Dusseldorf where the orientation of the painting is pretty obvious when you're looking at the thing. Nonetheless, Rothko thought that it was necessary to realign it, and he'd write on the back of the canvas the word up with an arrow. And you can see on that particular Dusseldorf work where he's actually crossed out his instructions and then applied them in the revised direction because he thought it looked better the other way. But the funny thing is, we've in the NGV in Melbourne got a work that's called Untitled Red, where the drips look like they're going up the canvas. And we get a feeling, in fact, that Rothko has a bit of a disregard for the direction of the drips. In fact, it sort of reminds me of the way Hitchcock would make a little cameo appearance in his films. I think Rothko came to see those drips as something a little bit quirky and a little bit of his sort of signature, if you like.
He did really kind of detest the people that loved his art. And I read that he was commissioned to paint a series of large canvases for a new restaurant restaurant in New York.
Correct.
It was for the rich and famous.
That's right, at the Four Seasons. And, of course, when he realised people would be eating their steak Diane underneath of it, he didn't quite like that idea anymore, so he pulled the contract.
Well, he gave the money back and he kept them all for himself. And more than that, when he planned them originally, he wanted the people who ate in that restaurant, who he called sons of bitches, to feel like they were bricked in, that they had no escape.
All I can say is it takes one to know one.
Yeah, probably. He looked a bit like Adolf Eichmann, which is interesting because he was a Jewish, Russian, I think Latvian.
Latvian. I think we should at this particular moment say sveiks, kaklajas to all of our Latvian listeners RPP. I'm sure we've got a large contingent listening today.
We do, and we always welcome them, and I would also like to say that if I could.
Sveiks.
But I won't. Sveiks. Look, we're running short on time, but little things like what sort of brushes did he use? Or did he use a roller? People would say he might have used a roller.
He sure didn't. In fact, one of his assistants recalls the velvet texture of Rothko's brushes. The brushes were really old and well taken care of. The brushes were washed every day after painting, and they were dipped in turpentine, then in detergent, and it would be rewashed. And this process would go on and on and on. And they became, over time, so malleable. They really became an extension of Rothko's hand, and that then meant the works became more expressive. And he would use brushes like a big 5-inch house painting brush, and he'd lightly flicker that over the surface. But his brush techniques were definitely a definitive player in his works. He could drag a relatively dry brush across the canvas. I think your John Baird's of the world would call that scumbling. Sometimes he used vigorous brushwork, which would result in bits of broken hairs remaining embedded in the painting. Sometimes the tempo of his brushwork would vary when he worked out closer to the edges of the painting or where he wanted thin spots for the ground to come through. He'd slow up a little so the paint wouldn't go on as thickly. He was a real genius when it came to working the medium.
Well, I don't know. The last time I bought a sable brush, it was a tiny little pointy thing. It was a miniature. It cost about $400. So I'm not surprised he washed a 5-inch sable brush, because those things would have cost a lot of money.
Yeah, that's very true. Might
have been. Did he have any other particular tools of trade?
Quirky devices? Yeah. Only probably the palette knife is worth mentioning, and we should put up on the Facebook page for Arts About one that's called Number 16, also known as Two Whites, Two Reds of 1957, where the palette knife really comes into its own as an important device. You'll notice on the bottom right-hand panel of the image, the white image, where you can see the evidence of a palette knife being scraped down the painting, which exposes some of the red underneath, and it sort of squares up the shape. He loved the idea of a white ground on a painting and then being able to scrape using the palette knife that provided the translucency to the surface.
Palette knife. You know, he killed himself with a palette knife, don't you?
He killed himself with some razor blades, actually.
No, he did not. He cut his wrists open with his palette knife.
Oh, my God. That sounds like Wikipedia to me.
He also cut his neck, and he bled. He landed. He slid off the sink, landed on the floor, and when they found him, it was interesting because it was approximately the size, I think, 6 by 8 in feet.
Oh, you're pathetic.
No, this is my research.
Okay. Anyway, that's highly reliable, I'm sure.
Yeah, highly reliable. Anyway, look, we've got to wind that up, but tracking you down in Prague, this has led me to a whole new world of art. Can we talk about what you're doing here in Prague at some stage in the future when it's not so secretive?
Of course. Well, it's been a pleasure to reconnect with you, friend.
Well, I'm going to take this back to Arts About and present it and tell them that I've tracked you down. I know where you are. I just want to find out what you're doing.
No worries.
Okay, so we'll see you soon, and we'll go back to you in the studio.
And now it's time for John On.
Don't you just love that sting, Mark? Yeah.
So the high seas again.
Can I just say,
yes,
before I get on to that conversation?
Yes, indeed.
Rothko Schmothko.
Oh, really? You're not a fan?
I think Will and Sally were quite right.
Will and Gabe.
Will and Dr. North were quite right to talk about Rothko's the beauty of his technique and the beauty of the objects that he made. But I have a problem with his claims that he was bringing a spirituality to the work that would be able to transfer to other people and put them in a godly state.
Oh, really? Do you?
Yeah. And I've just never enjoyed that claim.
No, okay, fair
John,
enough.
If I can just interrupt, John, perhaps
you Mark go, Stewart, we should say, has entered the building.
If you go to the Museum of Modern Art in New York, you might get close to a spiritual experience when
really?
You see some of the big Rothkos there. Yeah,
yeah.
It depends where you see them. They're
extraordinary. That one that we saw in San Francisco that they mentioned in that show, I would say the same thing. It was just absolutely extraordinary to
well,
be in
I'll,
the presence
I
of
I will hold my remarks in reserve.
Okay, then. Very good.
I went fishing once.
Yes. Did you get any fish?
Well, I decided I needed a different career for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll become a fisherman on a commercial fishing boat. And I made my way down to Portland on advice from some friends. And I got down there, had a look around, and the biggest boat there, bright blue fishing boat made out of steel, was called the Halcyon.
Mm.
And I decided that'll be my fella.
Right. Sounds like fun.
Yeah.
Halcyon.
Got aboard, and I asked to speak to the captain, and the captain appeared. He was about 19 or 20 years old, I think. And he said, yeah, well, if you want to come along, that's fine. What we'll do is you can come on a trip and we'll see if we like you and you can see if you like us. And that's the best way to get this kind of thing started. You'll need some warm clothes and a pair of gumboots.
Mm-hmm.
I went and bought some gumboots at the local hardware. As it turned out, they were pretty well designed to be the slipperiest things you can ever put on your feet. But
they do need to be well fitting. Yes.
Well, no, just the soles of them weren't good on a wet deck, I'm afraid. But we headed off out of Portland Harbour, and about maybe a kilometre out of the harbour, there was a small clicking noise, and the rock and roll came on at concert volume, AC/DC mm-hmm. from memory. And they all just started smoking marijuana cigarettes. The reefers were out and the rock and roll was on.
Once you were in international waters.
And I just thought, well, okay, so this is fishing, is it? I've never been fond of the joint myself, so I just let them get into that. We went maybe 12 or 14 hours southwest, so that we're out in the Southern
Ocean.
It's
a long way out, yeah.
Looking for orange roughy.
Yep.
And there was suddenly the boat kind of slowed down. There was some yelling coming down from the bridge, and there was a guy on the deck who seemed to be in charge of everything, who just did a lot of vile swearing at everyone.
Yeah.
And there was chains rattling around and big sort of nets coming off spools and lots of stuff going on, which I didn't understand. Didn't know anything about it. I wasn't being asked to do anything in particular. And so I watched all this unfold, but I also watched off in the distance to the west a growing gloomy greyness.
Oh, yes.
And was wondering about that. And as the day went on, the storm approached, and they started thinking, all right, well, we better get the nets out because we can see what's coming, you know. And they dragged the boat backwards into the nets, more or less. No catch, nothing at all. And the storm just, rather than creeping up on us, sort of hit us with a vengeance. And I ended up sitting in the middle of this boat in a small steel room with a group of five men who seemed to be sort of whispering to each other about how best to kill me and make it look like an accident, while they microwaved Hawaiian pizzas and drank warm beer.
Were you seasick, by the way?
No, not on that trip. I do get seasick, but not on that trip. And the little room I was in got hurled around from side to side all over the place. It was an extremely strange feeling. You couldn't see out of the room. You could just see.
This is hell. This sounds like hell to me.
So I went up. I thought, I'll go up to the bridge. And I got up in the bridge and there was another seat up there. There's the captain was up there strapped into his seat. There was another seat there. I strapped myself in. And the Halcyon, all 75 foot of her, was falling off the tops of waves and landing on her side in the troughs, which was pretty remarkable sort of stuff. And I remember thinking, if I didn't think that I was going to drown at any moment, this would probably be quite exciting. You know?
Oh,
but I didn't
yeah.
get a moment to enjoy it.
No,
it was terrifying.
Did you get any fish in the end?
No, and we spent 14 hours going into it, like across the storm essentially, back to Portland.
Lovely.
and tied up, and I got off the boat and I said, well, I don't think that's for me.
No, I was just going to say exactly the same thing. It sounds to me very much like John. Yeah. The life of fishing is something that you don't really need.
And I never used those gumboots again, Mark.
So this is something to do with Degas, John? Or
no, no.
Nothing at all?
Just a little story.
Okay.
Seeing as you're in here already, Mark, why don't we go straight into you and John's visit to the National Gallery and talk about the Degas exhibition? I'd love to hear a little bit about that.
Okay, well, I think we should start with the fact that Tony puts on a very good show.
Tony?
Tony Elwood.
Ah, yes.
Very good caterer.
Tony St Kilda, as I've noticed you call him.
A bit of respect for him. He has a hard job.
Yeah.
Very good food. Yeah. Beautiful to see the stained glass windows of Leonard French.
Yes.
At night.
It's always gorgeous.
And the Roger Kemp tapestries on the wall were also very beautiful.
The food was good, wasn't it? The
food was excellent.
A little bit of a lamb stew with some mashed potato.
Oh, that's not what you told me. I heard about souffle.
Well, that was later. There was souffle.
Yes, we saw the show and then we came back.
Mm. Oh, I see. It was a three-course gastronomical as well,
was
it?
It was going on for quite some time.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very good. And that was a lovely introduction to going to see Monsieur Degas, who we all know is not really the nicest man in the world, apparently.
Yeah.
People have said awful things about him, actually. Mm.
Well, they can say a lot of awful things about artists. We all know artists can be difficult people.
A bit crotchety.
Yes, and he was particularly antisocial, anti-Semitic, and asexual, apparently, as well, even though he managed to paint a lot of prostitutes and ballerinas.
Yeah, lost all his friends by the end of his life. No one would talk to him.
No.
Did
no,
he?
No.
Mm.
Yeah,
difficult. Was he married?
No.
Never.
No. Oh, okay.
No. But from an independently wealthy family, so he wasn't...
he lost all his money too. Well, his brother lost all the dough and he had to sort of recover by selling paintings. That sort of apparently changed the way he painted.
Right.
And but it's when the slightly more sentimental ballet dancer paintings started to appear.
Mm.
They were a little bit more...
They're still appearing, aren't they?
They're a little bit more easily slid into the marketplace,
yes.
I think.
Yes.
But what do you think of his painting? I think I've never really thought Degas was much good. I always thought he's a little too sentimental for my tastes. But then when we saw the show, there was quite a lot of stuff in there that I thought was beyond just interesting, that was actually quite riveting.
Mm. Yeah, there's some courageous pieces. I think his some of the unfinished work, apparently unfinished, quite courageous in the sense that he just suggested things and didn't actually finish them.
Right. Well, his remarks, of course, were along the lines that he didn't consider any painting finished, regardless of what the audience thought. So some of them finished at a point beyond, I mean, earlier than...
Than others, yeah.
Than others, yeah.
He said that, did he?
Yeah.
That they were never really finished works.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, it's a bit like...
He couldn't see how you could finish a painting.
Right.
It's a bit like Michelangelo, I think. He's showing people the processes so that you can actually see what he was doing.
You can see in there.
Instead of just a finished image where it's
like Cézanne.
A bit like Cézanne.
Cézanne was a different sort of fella, you know. He was a bit of a wit and he had a fight with Zola, of course, Émile Zola. But apart from that, he was quite a good guy. You know what he said about... I've got to remember which Frenchman it was. Well, I think it was Victor Hugo, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, Victor Hugo is a madman who thinks he's Victor Hugo. It's not bad, is it?
It's good. It's good. So back to the Degas.
Yeah.
It's a show definitely worth seeing.
Oh, definitely.
I think the sculpture's not really that as interesting as what it could be. I think it looks better in photographs than reality, actually. Whereas the paintings, there were some surprising pieces.
Yeah, and it's interesting to look at the relationship between his racehorse paintings and what John Brack was doing in Melbourne some years later. You perhaps aren't as familiar with those as I am. But Brack's racehorses definitely had a Degas feel about them. And so he must have been looking at those at some stage.
Sure.
And he was quite good with the racehorses.
Who, Brack or Degas?
Both of them in the end, but Degas we're talking about.
So. Yeah. Now, because I don't know those paintings at all, the horse paintings, but Degas, he didn't really like the categorisation. He didn't really like to be defined as an impressionist, isn't he?
Didn't like the term.
Didn't like it, no, which is probably what a lot of people would think about him, or that is who they would think that he was. What about that? Tell me about that.
Well, he was a pre-impressionist, really. He was not. He was older than all the others. He was a bit. I think he was more like Manet's age.
Yeah.
And so he was, and he didn't have to be defined as anything because he could just live on his own.
He did exhibit with the impressionists, though.
In the beginning, I think a couple of paintings, but he did. He was very helpful to them.
Didn't like the term and said so. No. But at the time, the term impressionists was something that was being used by the French press to describe what these madmen were up to.
Mm. It was derogatory.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yes, okay, of course. And of course, he brought something else to it. He was more, I mean, he had sort of classical interests, didn't he? And his work was quite different in many subject
lines. His original ambition was to be a history painter.
Oh, was it?
Yeah. Like all painters, you know, they all want to set out as history painters, I think, you know, make the big grand Delacroix style painting.
Yeah.
I don't know why he couldn't manage that, but he began to prefer the glimpse, and that's where the dancers came in. It was a sort of a slippery glimpse of what was going on behind the scenes. And, you know, we were looking at those paintings that had staircases, seemingly in the wrong part of the painting, you know, where they were hiding the dancers behind the staircase. Mm-hmm. And one wonders whether or not he's just doesn't want to paint all those dancers. He'll put some of them behind the staircase. Easier to paint a staircase.
So like people with hands in their pockets.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, Napoleon with his hand in his waistcoat. But I think, on the other hand, it's he and us who are behind the staircase, in fact. We're kind of peering around the staircase at what's going on in the room.
Yeah, he had the voyeur aspect. Yeah. It was very, very important to him. Mm. But he didn't, you know, when you looked at some of his, the Bellini family portrait, that was quite a beautiful painting, quite large.
Yeah.
Which was, he didn't do so many big paintings.
Oddly composed, too. He was into the that sort of asymmetric composition thing, and it's very clever stuff.
I've seen at various galleries around the place bronzes of those ballet dancers. Are there any sculptures there?
Yes, quite a few. Only bronze. Not compared to Rodin or even Matisse, he's not. I don't think he's such a brilliant sculptor.
No, he was famous for the ballerina, the little rat. Clothes,
Yeah, that's what everybody thinks of when they think of Degas, isn't it? Do you think, does this exhibition change your mind a little bit about that?
Not about the sculptures.
No.
The paintings, definitely. There was
his bronzes were mostly, I mean, it's all about the bum. He was a bum man.
Was he?
Yeah. It would seem to me.
Well, they were little rats. They didn't have much else to show, did they?
Maybe that's it. Yeah
maybe. Hmm. So what do you come out thinking of Degas? Is it a good exhibition?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's definitely worth seeing. There are some very good paintings there.
But there's a lot of paintings there too, you know. It's a big show. There's 200 paintings or something and photographs.
But one thing I'd like to say is that it'd be lovely to see if the NGV would be open at night more often, because I think it really brings out paintings and sculptures when you can see them at night.
At night?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, especially sculpture because you have the light.
Wouldn't the lighting be the same inside at night as it is during the day?
I don't. Well, maybe it's just our eyes are different when we come in from the night.
Well, it's a feel. It's the vibe.
Yeah, definitely the vibe as well. But I think it's always lovely to go into a museum at night.
I agree with you.
Slightly
erotic
about it.
Especially if there's souffle on.
Yeah. Indeed, which apparently there was. So this exhibition runs for some time now, doesn't it? Do you know when it goes on?
Blockbuster, it'll be on for months.
Yeah, great. Well, we've all got time to go and see it, but make sure you do, everybody. Fantastic. Thanks so much for coming in today, Mark. And while we get Cliff into the room, why don't we listen to a little bit of Johnny Ray with Josephine. Actor, writer, blogger, commentator and agitator Cliff Allen joins us again this morning. Good morning, Cliff. Welcome to Arts About.
Good morning, Sally.
How are you today?
Not too bad, yes.
Yeah, good.
Yes, I've had a pie and sauce.
Oh, have you?
Yes.
Yeah, that's good. Oh, you look very buoyed up this morning.
No. I'm a bit short-tempered about the arts and the performing arts. I mean,
morning, Cliff.
Good morning, John.
There's a disappointing lack of pie and sauce on the front of you.
No, I wiped it all off. I mean, I don't know, you know, all this political stuff. I've been listening to all the radio stuff all week, and I don't know, how many people actually are involved in the performing arts? I'm not talking about the smaller arts companies or the amateur theatre. I'm talking about the general public. Outside of the odd person that likes to go into a musical, the percentages must be about 99 to 1%.
What, you don't think enough, very many people go?
Well, no. We may well know why it's good for you and so on and so forth, but I get depressed when I listen to all the opinion from people, you know, in the newspapers, print, and also on the radio, and as a result of the election, and it's all over the place.
Well, I think you only need to look at the state of it all out there and think, well, there should be a lot more of them going to the theatre, because perhaps they'd be slightly more articulate and nicer people.
I come down to the conclusion that either most of them are wankers, I'm a wanker.
Oh.
So it's one or the other.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, can I say, I don't think you're a wanker.
Do you get to down a bit sometimes, or do you just keep punting?
Me?
Yeah, you.
I'm looking at
you, John.
Yeah. I don't get down particularly, no. I'm pretty buoyant generally.
Yeah.
So am I, but every now and again I just think,
For goodness sake, yes. I know, I agree. It has been all rather disappointing, and it is really a bit shocking to hear the sort of the level of dialogue that goes on. Anyway, we're trying to ignore the election now because it's over.
Well, the Art Gallery of New South Wales, now, they issued a new code of ethics and conduct with clear injunctions against free speech. Staff are not to express their views that disparage the gallery. This includes speaking engagements, comments on radio and TV, social media, blogs, letters to editors, articles in books, journals.
Who has put this
or
out?
Or notices, or anywhere it might be expected that such views will spread to the community at large.
What? Who has done this? Who's
the Art Gallery of New South Wales.
Oh, for goodness sake.
And what happens if the staff break the rule? They get less gruel or something?
Well, I don't know. I did watch that series on the Secret Police, which was produced by Film New South Wales and Film Canberra and Foxtel, and that was the greatest load of rubbish I've ever seen. Probably the worst series ever. But I sat through it because I was so disgusted. I don't know. It's to do with everybody being a bit scared, you know. I don't know what would happen to them. Anyway, apart from that, One thing I want to say, Justin Fleming's take on Molière's Les Femmes Savantes is called the Literati, or Literati. It's Molière's rhyming couplets to Australian English, performed at Griffin Company in New South Wales, in conjunction with Bell Shakespeare. But the interesting thing was, one of Fleming's great lines took the mickey out of himself and the creative genre of reconfiguring and rebranding the classics. And at times I've got very nasty about people that rewrite things, you know, and give their own interpretation. And in any case, I'm always impressed with anyone that uses the word genre.
Yeah. I'll keep that in mind.
Genre.
Anyway, what he wrote was, with so many people writing, it's a wonder there's anyone to read them. And there are so many people who cannot write, rewriting writers who could, and giving us appalling versions of works that used to be good. And there are some ingenious non-writers, of whom I'm sure you've heard, who can adapt a foreign writer in whose language they don't know a word.
Right.
Which is very clever.
Mm-hmm.
So he rubbished himself, and rightly so. But
This is Justin Fleming, is it? Was he the? He was the writer, and did he perform in this piece?
He's the writer of it all. Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, up there at the Griffin Theatre. Have you been to the Griffin? It's a beautiful little spot.
No, where is it?
It's near King's Cross.
No,
just
I don't
up
think
the
I
road
have been
there
to
from
the
King's
Griffin.
Cross. Yeah, it's full of really good, strong Sydney heights.
So this is a co-production of between the Bell Shakespeare Company and the Griffin, is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That's right.
All right, well, we'll have to look that up. Maybe I'll see if I can find it and put a link on our Facebook page.
Yes, another mention of Denmark's Follow the Money. I watched that.
Oh, yes, I watched the end of it.
Beautiful last episode.
Yeah, it was good, wasn't it?
Even the hero wasn't a hero.
No.
It was so good. You know, none of your traditional, I'm a good fellow or female and so on. It's just, it was beautiful.
It was a really gritty, fabulous story, wasn't it? Yes. Follow the Money. It's been on SBS. Yeah. Oh, it's still on SBS,
I've been watching, on iView, been watching Crownies.
I believe it's good. I haven't watched it.
Illegal genre, that is, Cliff.
Oh, the illegal genre. Yes.
I love that word. Yes.
And it's transformed itself into Janet King.
Yes,
so
that's right.
It's the same characters. Yeah. This, we're set in the same office and it's a courtroom drama, but they've changed the name from Crownies to Janet King. And I'm wondering whether it might be a writer's issue, like the original writers owned the name Crownies or something. Do they do that sort of thing?
Is Crownies Australian?
Yes, it
yeah,
is.
Yeah, it's the
yes,
same it's show, but they've changed the name of it.
No, I have seen it.
Yes.
Yeah,
I don't know. Do you know what I always thought Crownies was a terrible name, actually.
Yeah.
I wondered if that was it, because the association with beer and all of that. That was my thoughts about it, but I have no idea if that's why the name has been changed.
So they might have just at some stage bit the bullet and...
Well, you could equally be as right, is that there was a change of guard. Not sure.
Mm. I probably mention it because I'm not a great fan of her, the blonde lady.
No?
Marta?
No. I had a look at the lift out in the newspaper, and they have this big heading on arts and culture.
Yes.
Which you'll probably see in the Sunday Age or the Saturday Age. And all it is movie reviews.
Oh,
yeah. How's that arts and culture?
Yeah.
You know.
Well, that's the whole thing.
Big two-page article on Tarzan.
Oh, my God, it's this dumbing down of what is arts and culture? That's what half the people seem to think these days. It's so much broader than
that. I'm really down today.
It's you are
all
a little
depressing
bit cranky
today.
Yes.
Things might be better next week.
Oh,
absolutely,
I'm sure they
fabulous
will be.
The movie's coming early next month. You may not like Absolutely Fabulous, but I like Jennifer Saunders.
Oh, me too.
And I also like Joanna Lumley.
Yes.
And I loved her series on Greece. Did anyone see that?
Oh, yeah.
And Rebel Wilson's in that as well, too, their new movie.
And Julia Sawar. What's her name? Sawalia or something? She's grown up now. She's got a baby now, apparently. Well, probably the movie will be a pain in the neck.
I've actually heard good things about it, believe me.
Well, anyway, it's got Christopher Biggins and Judith Chalmers and Graham Norton and Barry Humphries and so on and so forth. But
those kinds of shows don't always transfer happily from genre to genre.
He's going to say genre every time he gets an opportunity now. You've said it about five times since Cliff's mentioned that, you know.
They're good for television later on when they've run their race.
Right.
On, you know, in the movie houses.
It's true.
I won't be going to see it. But theatre, no. All quiet today. Nothing to talk about.
Well, what are you going to be doing for the rest of the day then?
Well, as usual, I'll be writing my column, yet again another heavy political column today.
Oh, my goodness, really?
Maybe not. Maybe I'll just get stuck into the arts because I'm a little bit angry. And
are you angry at the arts or are you angry at people's reaction to the arts?
I'm angry at all those opinions I read and hear about. I'm angry to that lady in Queensland that ran a fish and chip shop.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes. Well,
and
we're
that
all
sort of
angry at her.
Person. And maybe a little bit at Darren Hinch too, because I seem to remember a long time back he's screaming about not letting anyone into our country and all these sort of things. I'm not going to take a political stance here and now, but there's a few people that I just think, wow. What are they doing?
Well, it's not just the arts that you're angry at then. I was just trying to get to the bottom of that. Now, we've got a song for
I'm
you.
I'm not angry at females.
Oh, of course not.
What
about a song?
From the Hollies.
All right.
Have you got that?
Yeah.
The Air That I Breathe. I've got a beautiful song for next week.
That'll be next week.
Yeah.
If I last till next week.
Thanks.
I'll never last till the next election, you know. That was my last election.
Oh, we'll see.
We'll see about that, yes.
They might be back at the polls before you know it.
You never know. Goodbye.
See you,
hello out there to all the lovely ladies.
It's time for the news.
It is. I can hear the typewriter going.
Hmm.
Now, 27th of August. Before you say anything, 27th of August, yes. Eastgate and Holst, a John Baird painting show.
Woohoo! That's exciting.
Well, we'll see.
Yeah, John Baird. I'm just writing that down. So that goes into the news next week as well. Right. Yeah. Hey, there's a new singing group that started up in at the Rye Beach Community Centre. And apparently, even if you say you can't sing, you don't need to worry because everybody's welcome and encouraged to sing together just for fun. It's for all ages, all abilities. And if the group takes off, they want to keep running these sessions. So get on board and sing in a fun, friendly atmosphere. I think you need to go to the website of the Arts on the Peninsula to work out how to contact them if you're interested in going. They're doing it on Fridays, I think.
Judy Singleton and Peter Ferguson, worthy of mentioning that they're both terrific artists.
Oh, yes.
And they'll be down at the Rosebud Plaza.
I think they might have finished, actually. I think I probably should have removed that from this.
June the 29th. Yes, that's gone.
It has finished, but they're fabulous. Yeah. And they were doing a terrific art event down at the Rosebud Plaza. If you didn't get down there, you've missed them.
They're helping with some ceramics at the moment. Which might
are turn, they?
Yeah, and they might end up in the show in Melbourne.
Have you got
the John Baird show in Melbourne?
Is there a John Baird show in Melbourne? Where is it, John?
At Eastgate and Holst.
Oh,
in
really?
Hawthorne.
What's the date?
27th of August.
Put that in your diaries, folks. Now, winner of the McClelland Achievement Prize in 2014, Sonia Pays has an exhibition entitled Parallel Futures that opened at McClelland on the 3rd of July, that's last week. Sonia Pays is a photographer and new media artist based in Melbourne. She's a master photographer with the Australian Institute of Photography, and this exhibition shows the evolution of her work from photography through to sculpture. It's showing in two galleries, the Elizabeth Murdoch Gallery and the French Gallery, and it's on until November, so get down there and see that.
The 65th Melbourne Film Festival is nearly on us. The 65th.
65th, isn't that incredible?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's older than me.
Yeah.
Get into their website and have a look.
Yeah. They've just announced their program, actually, so you can go onto their website and see what films are coming up. I think only in the last few days. Now, of course, the fabulous exhibition that John and Mark talked to us about, the Degas, A New Vision, Friday nights. Oh, yeah. It's on at the NGV.
Mark was suggesting that a chance to see that at night would be good, and there it is.
Yeah, that's right. They're going to have music, food and all sorts of things. So that could be a really great thing. If
probably
you can't get there during the day, go there at night
souffle.
On Friday. They probably won't have the fabulous souffle that you guys did.
No.
Paul Newcomb has a new exhibition of paintings coming in at Bright Space in St Kilda. He is an abstract painter of long standing and designed a closely matched collection of 50 luminous paintings. They're going to be on at Bright Space coming up in August. So I think we might get friend of the show, Carly Greer, in next week
to tell us
some more about that.
Yep. They're still calling for entries for Space, the annual open exhibition at the FAC. The deadline's July the 25th. Contact them for the details.
Oh, okay, yes.
Win yourself an exhibition.
Yeah, you could get your own exhibition. Ask for Miller down there.
Yeah.
So, everybody, if you've just tuned in, you've missed Arts About. But you can catch up on the show via podcast, which should appear on the station website sometime later on this week. The show's also repeated on Wednesdays. We're on air, we're streaming, and you can also listen to us at Wednesdays. Did I just say that? I did, didn't I?
Yeah, you got all that a bit much.
I got it all mixed up, yes. Yeah. I stopped reading it properly. Wednesdays at 12 if you've missed us today. You'll find a link to our Facebook page on the RPP website. Join us again next Sunday at 11. And remember, everybody, we may not know everything about art.
Brody knows what he likes.
He does. Thanks, Brody.